Well, we are back. Happy Hanukkah, everybody. And let's get started. Let's get into it. Before we start with number five, which is the one that we're up to now, I believe Mrs. Klatsko had a question about number four. So I'm gonna tell Mrs. Klatsko, what was your question? And we'll wanna make sure everybody gets it right before we go on, gets it clear.
Right. You said, the fourth principle, meaning that he's the first and the last. And like I said to you, my understanding is that he created time, he's in the very beginning, and he'll go on and on and on with into eternity. But then you answered a question I had with last means goal and first means cause. Can you explain that last sentence a little bit better? Last means goal and first means cause.
Yeah, so the idea that, again, we've talked about already in principle number two that God is one. He's all encompassing. So to simply understand number four as being, well, God created time, I mean that's on a simple level that's true. It's definitely true, but there's more that's being said here. When we talk about God as being first and last, so this is what we talked about last time, that first the term first implies that there is a second, right? So we're talking about the relationship between God and the next thing, a sequence, right? When you talk about first and last, you mean a sequence of things. What's the significance of a sequence, right? Why is that important that God is before something else? I mean, that God created something is important. That's true. But why is it important that he's before? What do we mean by that? It's a true fact, but what's the import of that? Why is that important? What does that mean? So what the sources that I was looking at talked about, Rabbi Shapiro primarily says that first means in terms of cause and effect. We look at time as time, one of the primary functions of time is to create sequence, which is to create an order of cause and effect. And to say something is the first, that means it's the original cause. That's what that means. That's the impact of that. And when you say something is last, you also don't just mean it happens to be the last man standing. You mean more than that. You mean more that this is the ultimate goal of everything. This is where everything's headed. So that's where we mentioned kind of the two chapters in Bereishis. The two goals. Anytime you want to build something, there's the technical, logistical, how it happened, and then there's also why is it happening or what's the purpose of everything. And those are kind of those two things. Those are kind of those two things. So first means, he's the original cause of everything, and then last means that he's the ultimate goal of everything. So you want to know why anything happens in this world? The answer is ultimately God, both from a logistical point, and also from a goal perspective. That's the import of that.
Okay.
Okay, very good. Okay, so we've covered the first four. Just to briefly recap what those first four were. The first one was just the very fact that there is a God that defines existence. The second one, we're going to say God is one. There's no parts to it. He's all everything pretty much. It's kind of what we're going to say, it all included in one. The third one, the second one is God is one. The third one is that he doesn't have a body. We said the way we explained that on kind of a deeper level is that it means that you can't even imagine God. Not only does not God have a physical body, that would be included in really in two, but it's the fact that you can't even imagine it. There's not even a conceptual thing to imagine about God. And the fourth principle we already said talks about how God relates to this world, that he created it, he's the first and he's the last, which means, like we said, the original cause and your ultimate goal. That's very simply put. Okay. Now, like we said at the very onset here, the first five are pretty much defining God. The next four are going to be God's instructions for the world. What are we supposed to do? What's the purpose? What are what's the instruction manual for the world? And the last four talk about consequences, whether we do or don't do those things. So right now we're going on to number five, which is the last of the first five, which is defining God pretty much. Now, the first three we said really define God kind of in the abstract, in the in the absence of his relationship to us, more like what he isn't, like we said, we find out what he isn't. The fourth one already touched on his relationship with us, but in a very broad scale. The fifth one, we're going to talk about how we relate to God in a very specific way, and what his role is in that. Again, we're not talking about specific, you know, commandments and mitzvahs and things like that, but we're talking about the relationship of God in the world and something important to that. So let's get right into it. The fifth principle is like this. Ani ma'amin be'emunah shlema, I believe with perfect faith. She'habori yisbarach shemo, lo levado roi lehispalel, v'en lezulasa roi lehispalel. That it is only proper to pray to God. One may not pray to anyone or anything else. Now, at first blush, this sounds to be a detail. I mean, this sounds to be like a detail. You know, there's a mitzvah to daven. It's one of the 613 mitzvahs that we have to pray. And, okay, so there's within the mitzvah of davening, you should only pray to God, not to anything else. Obviously, this is a principle of Judaism. This is not a detail in a mitzvah. So why is it that this fifth principle, why is this a overarching principle? Why is this next on the list? Again, that it's only proper to pray to God. One may not pray to anyone or anything else. Okay, anyone who just want to take a stab at that question, why is that so fundamental? Why is this not just a detail, so to speak?
Because it would be idolatry if we were to pray to anyone else.
Well, absolutely, it would be idolatry. And the Torah is obsessed with idolatry. I mean, if you look at the Torah, it's all over the place. You go through Navi, the prophets talks all about idolatry. So yeah, absolutely. Idolatry is obviously something which is very, very wrong and very damaging. So you're right. We have to understand this principle in the guise of idolatry. We have to understand that. We have to understand what's bad about idolatry. And to make it relevant to us, I mean, why does that matter? We don't do idolatry today. We don't, you know, we don't, it's not a thing. So now what's interesting about it is, the principle does not say don't do idolatry. In other words, if you go to the Ten Commandments, right? First of the Ten Commandments is I am the Lord your God. And the second one is don't have any other idols, right? I do believe I saw somewhere that it's worded in this way of talking about prayer more as opposed to, you know, just specifically talking about idolatry is because precisely because of what we just said, that we don't really have idolatry today in the same way they had it back then. And therefore, we want to talk about it in terms that relate to us more, which is how do we pray and what do we pray to, as opposed to just saying don't worship idols. But I really want to get to the foundation of this. What's so bad with idolatry? Why is it so wrong? What was idolatry? What is idolatry? Why is this relevant to us? And understand what prayer is. What's prayer? Why is prayer specific? In other words, another question that we could ask is that, why are we talking about prayer? Just say, don't believe in any other gods, right? You know, belief in one God, don't believe in any other gods. We were talking about belief until now. So wouldn't that be the same thing, right? I mean, the second of the Ten Commandments says don't have any other gods. So I would think maybe the fifth principle would be don't have any other gods other than God, right? Why are we specifically talking about prayer? Why is that the element? I mean, If other gods have commandments that tell you to do things, you know, would that be any fundamentally different than prayer? Yes.
Could I take a stab at what might be the purpose
of
the focus on prayer?
Sure.
I don't know. I'm just trying. If we are praying to God, we are acknowledging that He is present and involved on a constant basis, that's like one of the principles, right? He's the beginning, he's the goal, God is involved in every aspect of the world as it is, and it's every detail of what's happening.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. We're going to expound upon that point that you just made. Yes. Mrs. Klatska, you wanted to say something?
Oh, just that it's more than this word. It's more than just loyalty. It's you know, he wants to have a relationship with us. And so if we're talking to somebody else and acknowledging somebody else, we're cutting that off and we're acting like he's not real.
Right. Okay. Excellent. Okay. Let's get into this and let's get unwrap some layers here. The Maharal asks a very interesting question, which some may not consider to be a question, but the Maharal thinks it is a question. So the Maharal thinks something is a question. I'm going to assume that he knows what he's talking about. So here's the Maharal's question. He says, we believe God runs the world. He has a plan, etc. So if God wants something to happen, he plans on something to happen, so why do we have to pray? God ordains it to happen. It'll happen. And if God doesn't ordain it to happen, then it won't happen. So what good is prayer? Basically, what's prayer doing? What's the purpose of prayer? What's the purpose of praying to God? If it's supposed to happen, it'll happen. And if it's not supposed to happen, it won't happen. So where does prayer come in?
We're asking him to change us, to make us better so that we're more worthy of what we're asking for. That's one part.
Okay. So let me explain what he says, or Rosh Shapiro also talks about this as well. And this is just innately I think we all understand this, but by articulating it in a very clear way, it'll give us a framework to deal with idolatry, to deal with God. There's two types of relationships you'll have with something that has an influence in your life. Okay? Call them wills and systems. Okay, for example, your car has an impact on your life, right? If your car doesn't work, you won't be able to get to where you need to go, and it's going to impact your life in some way, shape, or form. Your car also requires input from you so that it functions, right? You have to put gas in it. You have to change the oil every once in a while. You got to make sure the battery works, right? So there's definitely things that you have to do. You have to interact with your car, right, to make sure that your car works for you. Right? If you don't treat your car right, it's not going to work for you, and therefore your life will be negatively impacted. Okay? Then we have people, right? Spouses, let's say, right? They impact our lives in a very big way, right? And they also require a certain input on our part in order for them to be able to function in the way that we need them to function, to benefit us, right? If we treat our spouses nicely, they'll probably be nice to us. If we don't treat them nicely, they probably won't. So there are two basic different types of relationships. And obviously, there's a fundamental difference between the two of them. What I would say, the way I would call it is wills or systems, okay? There are inanimate systems, right, which don't have a will. They're just pre-programmed. Okay, so your car does not have a will, right? Your car has no will to do anything. Your car is a system, and the system will work based on the input you put in, and it may not work based on the input you don't put in. But there's no will there. Whereas a human being has a will, a human being has free choice, and therefore you are actually at the mercy of the person's will. So you can do everything right, and the person can still decide no. You could do everything wrong, the person still said yes. In other words, it's not 100% based on your input. It's a completely different system. You can't have a relationship. When you talk about a relationship with anything, a real relationship, we talk about relationships with a person. So even with people, there's two ways to have that sort of relationship. You could have a relationship that's more of a system type relationship where, you know, let's say it's a business relationship, right? If I give you this, you'll give me this. I'm manipulating the system, or I'm working with the system, or you could have a relationship of wills. Let me outline a distinction, a fundamental distinction between the two of them. A relationship with a system always functions based on a need, a lack that I have. I will never enter into a relationship with a system if it can't provide me something that I don't have, right? I will only enter into a relationship with the system, whether it's a robot, whether it's nature itself. Any other a system that I'm engaging with, I'm only engaging based on what it has to provide me that I don't have, The things that I have, I don't need the system for. And therefore, there's zero reason for me to engage and relate with that system. With a real relationship with a person, when you're talking about a meeting of wills, so to speak, you can have a partnership where it's, I don't need you, but I share a will with you, and therefore we can do something together, even though I don't need you. What I want is what you want. What you want is what I want. And therefore, we have a relationship based upon what we have versus what I don't have. With a will, I can relate to somebody based on what I have. I can decide, this is my goal in life. This is what I possess. This is what I stand for. And I want to share that with somebody else. That I can only do with a will, a person who shares that will. I can never do that with a system. The only way I will interact with a system is I'm missing something. The system can provide me something that I lack. I interact with the system that way. Okay? Everybody understand what I just said? It's I'm saying it in a very abstract kind of a way, but it's very fundamental. Idolatry does not have a will. There are spiritual systems in the world. There are. We don't necessarily have the ability today to do this. But at one point, there are systems in this world, right? The Talmud tells us that every blade of grass has an angel over it that tells it to grow. For every physical thing that exists in the world, there's a spiritual being on top of it. We talk about in the Torah about the angel of Esav. There is an entire spiritual world that pattern mirrors and actually runs the physical world that we live in, right? And one can technically pull strings in the spiritual world if they knew what they were doing, right? You can do certain things, you could say certain things, whatever it is, and you would actually be able to manipulate the spiritual world in your favor, right? There was an element of that to idolatry. And it was real. It wasn't just, it wasn't, people weren't stupid. I mean, there was something that they were doing. The problem was that they weren't interacting with a will. They were interacting with a system. So I can interact with a computer system. I can interact with a car. I can interact with nature. Nature's a system, right? So take, climate change or whatever. The way we treat the planet, right, will impact to some degree, and depending on who you ask, how much or how much we have control over that. But there's no question that human behavior can impact the way the world works in some level, right? So that's us interacting with the system, right? Prayer is no part in that. In that sort of relationship, right, one would absolutely ask the Maharal's question. In other words, if I put oil in my car will run. If I don't put oil in my car will not run. Me talking to my...
What was Maharal's question again?
His question was, if it's supposed to happen, it'll happen, and we don't need prayer. And if it's not supposed to happen, it won't happen. How's prayer going to help? That question is absolutely true when it comes to systems, right? Me talking nicely to my car is not going to make it function better. If I put the oil in, it'll work. If I don't put the oil in, it won't work, right? If we treat the planet well, it'll run. If we don't treat the planet well, it won't run, right? And whether we talk to the planet or not is completely meaningless because there's no will. The planet doesn't have a will. It will do exactly what we do to it, right? The concept of prayer is having a relationship with something, having a relationship that implies will, that implies choice, that implies desire, right? You can't have a conversation with a system. Now, even though you can imagine, they have now, on certain, they have bots, certain websites, you go into the website and you type in, what are you looking for? And they'll have a computer algorithm that will respond to you and it'll tell you, you say, hi, my name is Joe. What can I help you with today? Right. And you type it, I'm looking for a new car part. Right. And it'll tell you what kind of car do you have? And you could have a very long conversation with a computer, essentially, right? That's not a relationship. That's not a conversation. That's just input and output. That's an algorithm, right? That's not prayer. Prayer is conversation to a will. That's interacting with a system. So any type of idolatry is only going to be interacting with a system. So when we go back and look at this fifth principle, it is only proper to pray to God. One may not pray to anyone or anything else. It's not merely stating a prohibition. It's not merely saying don't pray to anything else. It's stating that prayer doesn't have any meaning to anything else. There's no concept of prayer with anything else. You may say words to a wall. You may type in words into a computer bot. That's not a conversation. So idolatry had elements of that. Idolatry had elements of me saying words to a system and the system responding to my words. But that's not prayer. So again, I'm saying this to bring out the point that prayer really only applies to God. There cannot be prayer to anything else. God is the only thing other than other human beings that has a will in the universe. So when you talk about prayer, you're talking about having a conversation. That conversation can only be conducted with somebody with a will, a being with a will. The only other being with a will, other than people, is God. And therefore, prayer only applies to God. Prayer does not apply to anything else. Another way to put this principle is that we can have a relationship with God because he has a will and we have a will. We can't have a relationship with anything else in the universe other than other people and God. Right? We talked about last week, what does it mean we're created in the image of God? This is what it means. Right? Like we said last week, we have a will. God has a will. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we can relate to God because we both have wills. The same way we relate to another person who has a will, right? People who don't have a will, for whatever reason, they don't have a mind of their own, you can't really relate to them. You can physically interact with them. You could have input and feedback on a system level, you know, where it's just mechanical, but you can't actually feel like you have a relationship with that person because that person does not have a will. Right, you can only relate to a will. That's it. So either people or to God. That is the fifth principle, really, in a nutshell. And this is why idolatry, it's called avodah zara, which means a strange. Avodah zara literally means strange worship. So typically, simply that means it's strange because it's not God. But the Gemara says that it's strange even to those that worship it, or estranged. In other words, if somebody worships another god, they are estranged from that god too. The god, we're not estranged from that god. We're relating to the god himself. When it comes to a system, it's literally like you're talking to a robot. You're talking to a bot on a computer. That's what Avodah Zarah was. Now, it could be effective. In other words, if you know what you're doing, it can have impact in the spiritual world, and it can have impact on this world, you know, but it's not a relationship. Yes.
Is that why there's that something called Sitra Achra, the other side? You know, sometimes that's part of the reason the Ramban said there is something to it, to all these magical things. And the Rambam said there wasn't. It doesn't even matter because... So that's kind of explains to me a little bit about that other side, that Sitra Achra, because it's cold.
Right. It's cold. It's absolutely personal cold.
System. Right. It's a system.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And they're all systems God created, and they're all under God's jurisdiction too. I mean, let's not forget that, right? Mm-hmm. There's no system that's outside of God's jurisdiction. He created all the systems and he runs all the systems. But technically one can manipulate those systems. The same way one can manipulate nature and manipulate any physical element of the world, right? But that's not a relationship. That's fundamentally different from prayer. Okay. Now, what is this? How do we bring this real to us? I mean, so we don't have idolatry today. You know, people don't worship gods in that sense. And we'll talk a little bit more about this in the next one when we get to it, which we'll get to very soon. about prophecy. But what does this mean for us today? So let me make it a little bit more real. What do we see governs our life, right? We look at the world and there's basically three things that can govern our lives. There's other people, there's systems, and then there's God, right? So we may not relate to the spiritual systems of idolatry that they were tapping into, but we definitely relate to other systems in the world, cold, unthinking, unfeeling systems, whether it's, economies, whether it's, government, things like that. And we look at those things and we have to be careful not to worship those things, not to invest too much in manipulating those systems to where we think those systems are really running our lives. They're not. Only God can. I want to mention one other point here, which I think is important. The truth is that prayer really only exists outside of the systems of the world. We don't really pray for nature itself. We pray for what's beyond nature. There really is no reason to pray for what's natural. What's natural and what's normal, that's what's natural and what's normal. The realm of prayer starts with the recognition that God created all the systems and God can change the systems or manipulate the systems to benefit, in whatever way he wants. And that's really where prayer starts. And this is really what the Maharal talks about, again, in his question, is that you don't need to pray to God that nature happens naturally, because nature happens naturally. And you also, it's inappropriate to pray to God that the supernatural happen, again, within the system, because that's impossible, right? So what is the realm of prayer? And the answer is the realm of prayer is the recognition that God controls the systems and God can manage the systems. And that's what all our prayer ought to be directed to. That is prayer. That's the essence of prayer. It's, God, we know you created these systems. We know this is how they work. We know you're in charge of them too. Let's align my will with your will, and your will with my will, and let's see if we can't, rig the systems to work in our mutual will's favor. That's pretty much what prayer is. That's kind of a summation of prayer. It's not even so much, God, I need this, give it to me, because that has very little meaning also. It's like, why should God give it to you, right? It's only in as much as our wills align that it makes sense, right? If you think about it, we say all the time, Yehi Ratzon Milfanecha, may be your will, God, right? That's what we're saying. May your will align with what I want. Not that I can manipulate God's will, but I'm expressing a hope that my will is aligned with God's will, and that he'll see it within his will to align with what it is that I want, right? That is the essence of prayer. And that's really, again, we could have a whole other talk about prayer, but that's basically what prayer is, and that's kind of the gist of this fifth principle. I believe we're perfectly clear that only proper to pray to God, and one may not pray to anyone or anything else. Okay, let's get to the questions here, and then we'll move on to the next one. Number one, why is idolatry forbidden?
I think it undermines the concept of one God. I am your God.
Absolutely.
And there's none like unto him.
And the second that somebody starts talking to anything other than God, he's talking to a system. And that's absolutely wrong. Okay. Why is it forbidden to worship an angel if one still believes in God? Why is this an error?
Because an angel is not God.
Because.
Right. Yeah, Mrs. Klaska?
It's like what he said. It's just the idea that he made the angel, so why would you pray to the angel?
Right. Well, it's number one that he made the angel, and number two, the angel has no will of its own. So the angel is just a robot, basically.
Right, yeah.
So it's meaningless. It's meaningless to pray to an angel. Okay.
So, and the angel is part of a system that God is in control of, so that's why it's meaningless.
Correct. Right. Correct. Yeah. Number three, Christianity teaches that one can only approach God through Jesus. How would this principle apply to that belief?
Well,
we don't believe in intermediaries, so we believe a direct relationship between each of us and God. But we don't, even though sometimes we go to cemeteries. I mean, you know, some of the Hasidim do this and pray to the spirit of a departed master. But you know, but normally we go directly to God. We do this every day in our prayers.
Correct. It's an interesting point you point out. The part of praying in cemeteries, things like that. There's a couple different approaches to that question. You know, what are we doing in the cemetery? Are we praying to the deceased? The basic way that I like to understand, and there are other approaches here, but the basic way that I like to understand is that we're not actually praying to the deceased. We're just talking to God that he should do things in the merit of the deceased.
Okay.
And we're not asking the deceased to do something for us. It's you know, in the merit of, in their merit, you know, God, do this. But we're addressing God the entire time.
The other reason that the Christianity is found, because it's a system. It's like you're praying to a system.
Right. No, Trinitarian. Yeah, I mean, if he's a human being, he has a will, but a human being has no power, you know, ultimately over the universe. So, I mean, to pray to a human being is meaningless because he has no power to help you, right? And the second you're going to tell me he's something more than a human being, right? So he's, you know, somehow the divine. There is no other will in the universe other than human beings and God, right?
Right.
That's it.
So it's basically about the Zara, yeah. It's idolatry, right?
Well, right. So, I mean, again, it depends exactly what it is that they think they're doing. And, I, you know, it may be, you know, that they think they're talking to a human being. I mean, we again, a human being doesn't really have power, so it's that's foolishness. That's not Avodah Zarah if they think of him as a human being. If they think of him as God with godly powers, that's Avodah Zarah, right? That's ascribing, you know, that would be a form of Avodah Zarah. Excellent. Okay.
But they think of Jesus as Mashiach, as described in our texts, as Mashiach. So that's, they're wrong.
I don't know what they really think. There's Mashiach, there's Son of God, there's the Trinity, there's God embodied. I mean, there's all these different expressions. I don't know if they know what all these expressions mean. Like, you know, Mashiach is a very different concept than, first of all, I don't even know what the concept of Son of God means. I don't even know what that concept means. I don't even know what God embodied in a human being means. Again, the way we're defining God, it's impossible. So, you know, in principle number three took care of that one. So it's very murky. I don't know. Maybe they have something more worked out. I have no idea. But frankly, it doesn't really concern us all that much. I mean, we know we believe in whatever they believe, they believe. But I guess it matters whether you want to know is going to a church going to be considered going into a house of idolatry or not. Okay. I mean, that's I don't know the answer to that. Like, you know. Okay. How does belief in idolatry diminish our concept of God?
Well, like you were saying, the point of prayer is essentially to recognize that God is the source of everything. And once we pray to another entity that doesn't have that power, then we're diminishing that, the belief that we have that God is the essence of everything.
Precisely. Okay, number six, an earthly king depends upon his subordinates to help him rule. Is this true of God? How does this relate to this principle? Well, that's an interesting question. In other words, even an earthly king, he may have ultimate power, but he can't do everything himself, right? So he has all of these servants and systems and governors and whatever it is to actually implement his will. Does God work that way? How does that work? How would you answer that question?
Well, he doesn't really need us, but we're supposed to be partners with him. And so in some ways we carry out his will.
Well, I think it's more not talking about people. I think it's more talking about, you know, the spiritual realms and the sun, moon, and stars and nature and all the different things that make up the, in other words, does God need the sun to shine light onto the world? In other words, how, is that God using a subordinate to kind of do something for him? How do we understand that conceptually?
But doesn't I thought we say God uses angels that
right? So what does that mean? That's the question. In other words, do they have autonomy? They're not have autonomy. Are they subordinates? How does that work? How does that relate to this principle?
Just do what he wants. They just do what he wants.
Right. So what I would say is, and the way I want to describe this, the difference between, I think we may have mentioned this in a previous class, the distinction between me hitting somebody with a baseball bat and me punching somebody wearing a rubber glove. What's the difference between those two things? Right? A very weird analogy. When I hit somebody with a baseball bat, I'm actually using the force of the baseball bat to do damage, right? I wouldn't be able to do that damage without the bat. The bat has a certain weight to it and a certain bulk to it. And it's actually part of what's happening is a result of the weight of the baseball bat that's doing damage beyond what my own fist can do, right? When I wear a rubber glove on my hand, right, there's literally nothing more that the glove is doing that my fist can't do, except that there's a little veil that you can't really see my hand. You can just see the glove, right? That's what God is with everything else in the world. It's not that God needs the sun to shine light onto the world, right? It's not that God's using the sun as a baseball bat. And again, these are just analogies, but it's not that God's using the sun as a baseball bat. It's that God uses the sun as a glove so we can look at something and see, oh, that's the sun, but it's really just God.
Like it's an extension of you.
It's not an extension that adds anything. The extension itself.
Right. Right. It's just part of
it. It doesn't add anything at all. It's just a film. It's just a facade. It's just something. It has zero power on its own to do anything. And all of its power comes directly from God.
Ted, can I just ask? I'm sorry, a question. Sure. So you said the word shield, that it acts as a shield. In a way that keeps us from seeing.
Correct.
The actual power behind it, which is God.
Right. We can't see God. We can't see God. We see the sun. we see the sun.
Right. So instead, you're right.
God acts through the sun. God acts through nature. But it's not as if the sun is a baseball bat, and it's not as if nature is a baseball bat. It's all God, and it's more akin to a rubber glove than a baseball bat. Okay, so there really is no power in any of these things, independent of God's own power. Okay, any final questions about that one before we move on to number six?
The question is, you mentioned about God being with the rubber glove, but sometimes God acts in severe ways, pandemics or holocausts, in very heavy, big ways. That's God too.
I want to leave human choice out of it, because that's a different question. In other words, in a pandemic, for sure. A pandemic was not a human decision, let's say. Things that have, the Holocaust, you're already talking about human decisions. That's a different discussion, but I want to leave. But there's no question that God does do harsh things. There's no question about it. And anybody who opens up the Torah and just looks in the Torah, it's right there. God doesn't hide it. I mean, God's pretty pretty straightforward about what it is that can happen if we don't do what we're supposed to do. When we talk about reward and punishment later on, we'll get into that and maybe some reasons for why God does those things. Yes.
Just one question. It might be too much to go into now, but I just want to throw it out there. When another participant mentioned Hasidim, they go to a Rebbe as an intermediary. So I'm just curious about how that fits in to all of it. I understand it might be too big for now, but.
Again, on a very simple principled level, if they think that the Rebbe contains godly powers and they pray to him or worship him in that sense, then that would be avodah zarah, no question about it. If they just see him as somebody who is, you know, on a higher spiritual level than anybody else, and a model and somebody to take advice from, and somebody who maybe they can play a role in helping him in his service of God, you know, that's all fine and good. So my understanding of most Hasidus is that they see themselves as, you know, maybe the Rebbe's service of God is stronger and more acute than everybody else's. And maybe they're there to kind of help him in his service of God, which is true. I mean, there's, you know, we have that concept of people that are there to assist other people serving God. That's all fine. Once it gets to the point where the Rebbe actually has powers to manipulate things in the world, you know, akin to a God, akin to a deity, then you'd be bordering on Avodah Zarah, and that's where things would get pretty dicey.
It's not that different than when we say that we pray in the merit of someone, right?
Because we say that a lot. Every Shemona Esrei, we start off, you know, the merit of the Avos. The merit. That's totally fine.
It's the same thing, though, really. It could be.
It could be. If they're addressing God, if they're talking to God, and they're you know, invoking the merit of the Rebbe, that would be fine. If they're talking to the Rebbe and telling the Rebbe to do things that are... that would be problematic if somebody sent messages to a Rebbe that asking the Rebbe to literally do things, you know, that would be a problem. That would be bordering on Avodah Zarah. Yes. Okay. The sixth principle is, now we're getting into God's instructions for the world. Okay. So we've just defined God as relationship with us. Okay, what does he want from us, right? So the first key towards getting to that point is understanding that there is something called prophecy. Okay, I believe with perfect faith that all the words of the prophets are true. Now, obviously, this means the true prophets. This doesn't mean the false prophets, right? There have been many false prophets throughout the years, and there's very specific prescriptions about how to determine who is a false prophet and a true prophet, which the Rambam goes into at length, and those are in the packets that you have in front of you. Very, very specific. What the rules are for that. Let me start off with the following question, talking about prophecy. How would our world look different if there wasn't prophecy? I mean, there isn't prophecy today. We don't have prophecy today. That's clear. How different would our world be if it didn't have prophecy? I mean, why is this such a big deal? Yeah,
brother. We wouldn't know the Torah.
We wouldn't know the Torah. Yeah, I mean, That's pretty straightforward. We wouldn't know the Torah. I want to talk about how fundamental this is. And again, it sounds remote and it sounds not fundamental to us because, again, we don't have prophets today, so we don't experience it. But it's absolutely essential that there is something called prophecy to the world. And let's get into it. Let's get into what prophecy actually is. I do want to continue this one. There's only 10 minutes left today, but I do want to continue this one next week because there's really a lot to unpack here. A prophecy is typically something that we just kind of gloss over and there were prophets once upon a time and now it's just the Torah, which, I mean, that's true. We have the Torah, we learn it. But there's a lot to be learned from here. I'm going to throw out let's start the following way. So what is Nevuah? What is prophecy? I think people typically kind of get this picture of, like, you know, a booming voice coming out of the sky, Noah, right? We all have these. That's not prophecy. Let's look at how the Rambam defines prophecy, okay? And very interesting words here. And I'm going to, again, this is the rationalist Maimonides, you know, very, very, you know, the rationalist, right? And he's defining prophecy. So in the very first thing, we have the commentary on the Mishnah. Okay? Just to read that first thing. We must realize that there exist human beings who have such lofty qualities and achieve such great perfection that their souls become prepared to receive pure spiritual wisdom. So first of all, their souls receive the wisdom. It's a different kind of wisdom. In other words, the booming voice from the sky is using the same mind that we use to understand everything else, the same faculties that I would listen to another human being talk to me, I would listen to a booming voice from the sky. And the content of that communication is the same content that I would hear from any other person. The only difference is the method where it came from and the method of deliverance, maybe, right? That's not prophecy. When we talk about prophecy, we don't just mean a different being communicating through a different message of communication. We mean the nature of the communication itself is fundamentally different. The wisdom that's being imparted is a different sort of wisdom, and the faculty with which the human being uses to receive that wisdom is not the mind.
Mm-hmm. The soul, right?
It's the soul. So it's entirely different from another human being talking to you, right? When I talk to you, I'm talking to your brain, and I'm saying, I'm using colloquial wisdom, right? Prophecy is, in the words of the Rambam, their souls become prepared to receive pure spiritual wisdom. Let's continue. The next line is even more.
Is that what Ruach HaKodesh is?
No.
Or Ruach HaKodesh is a step down from prophecy.
Okay.
So we'll talk about that.
All right.
The next line, their human intellect can then become bound up with the creative mind and receive an inspired emanation from it. that line is so, I mean, it's just so much packed into that line. First, they get this, their soul receives pure spiritual wisdom. Then their human intellect can become bound up with their with the creative mind. What does creative mind mean? The Hebrew term is seichel hapoel. There's two things. In terms of the Rambam, there's seichel enoshi, there's human intellect, and seichel hapoel, which is active or creative intellect. So the Rambam is teaching us a whole another sort of intellect. We typically think of intellect as one. There's one type of intellect. There's human intellect, common sense, human logic, reasoning, that's one type of intellect. There's another type of intellect, says the Rambam, called Seichel HaPoel, which, again, creative mind is how he translates it here, but it doesn't mean human creativity. It's a completely different type of Seichel than of intellect. And why is it called active or creative as opposed to the human one? I mean, is human intellect not active? Is human intellect not creative? I know a lot of very creative human beings, right? So he's saying there's two things. Now I'm just reading the words here, and then we'll kind of unpack this. What does that mean? Their souls can become prepared to receive pure spiritual wisdom. Then their human intellect can connect to the Seichel HaPoel, this active intellect coming from God, and receive an inspired emanation from it. So God doesn't communicate in the form of human intellect. God communicates in the form of what we call Seichel HaPoel. The Seichel HaPoel can then, within a person, somehow connect up with the human intellect and affect how he thinks.
So is it called the creative Seichel HaPoel, creative, because the creator, God,
so let me
the intellect of the creator, is that why it might be
it's more than that. More than that. Let me explain what it is. This comes from Rosh Shapiro. I'll give you an analogy, and we're going to have to continue this next week. But let me give you an analogy, the following analogy. The first iPhone comes out, right? So Steve Jobs is very excited about it, and he sends two copies to two of his buddies. One of them is an old high school buddy of his. The other one is an engineer that he went to engineering school with. I don't even know if he went to engineering school, but whatever, right? The high school buddy takes the phone, opens it up, and sees all the functionality of it. Look at what it can do. Look at all these wonderful things it can do. Okay. The engineer takes the phone, plugs it into a computer, and starts reading the code. Human intellect today has zero ability to affect the world. Our human intellect can't change the world. Our human intellect is an observer. We're an end user. We observe the world. We make observations about it. We think it informs how we act. But the information that we're dealing with is user end information. The user experience, right? That's the information. It's whatever anybody would open up an iPhone and see the front of the phone and see all the apps. That's what the information that they're getting. That's not the actual information that created the thing or makes it work. You can't then go and tweak the way the thing works based on that information, right? We can't, with human intellect, go ahead and change the way the world works, right? We're not privy to the code, right? We're just dealing with the user end experience. It's called receptive intellect is the term that we use for it in Hebrew, as opposed to the Seichel HaPoel, which is the active or the creative one. Seichel HaPoel is God's intellect, so to speak. It's a system of wisdom, which is the code for the world. To the extent that if you know the code, the same way that the engineer can know the code, he can then go in and completely rework the entire device. Right?
So
if he wants to, he can. Prophets can do miracles. You know how? This is how. They can hack into the universe.
Okay.
They can hack into the underlying code of the universe. Prophecy is an emanation of a wisdom which is the underlying code of the universe.
So when it can.
Yeah, Doug.
So if it's the underlying code of the universe and it comes to us, we're probably overwhelmed by it and we have no clue what's going on. But that creative person, the creative thing you said, that their mind has some ability then to turn and to interpret it somehow. That's what it kind of means.
Well, right. So this intellect or this wisdom, whatever you want to call it, it exists on a separate server. Like it doesn't really exist in our brains.
Well, right. It comes from outside.
And it can only exist within us in the neshama too. It can't really exist in our brains. Right. It's like on the phone itself. Right. On the screen of the phone, I'm only going to be able to get the active user stuff. If I want the code, I've got to go onto a different platform where the code is, right? The code doesn't show up on the user interface, right? Our human experience, right? Let me express it this way. There's four parts to a human being. There's a guf, nefesh, ruach, and neshama. Okay, what are these four things? The guf is our physical bodies, right? That's the guf. The nefesh is our emotions, our emotional health, our mental health, anything non-physical, which contributes to our ability to be moral. Animals have this, right? And there's a physical part to an animal. There's also a non-physical part to an animal, right? Animals feel, animals think. That's what we call the nefesh. Human beings have a nefesh too. That's the realm of all sorts of non-physical emotions, thoughts, feelings, memories, etc. That's the nefesh. Then there's ruach. The ruach is the realm of morality. Okay, it's where we make our decisions. It's where our bechira comes in, our free will comes in. Animals don't have that. They don't make moral decisions. So animals don't have a ruach. They only have a nefesh. They have a guf and a nefesh. Human beings have a guf, a nefesh, and a ruach. The ruach is our ability to make moral choices. That's what it is entirely. That's still very much this worldly, right? It's very much this worldly. It's not physical. It's non-physical. But our ability to make moral decisions, our conscience. Is part of the ruach, okay? Our conscience is not the same thing as I'm sad when somebody passed away. That's nefesh, that's an emotion. That's in the nefesh of a human being. The conscience exists in the ruach. That's part of the moral bone of the person, the moral sense. Then there's something called the neshama. We really have very little active awareness of our neshama. We really don't today. Almost everything that we experience is either the guf, the nefesh, or the ruach. We experience physical sensations all the time. That's all the guf. We experience emotions and feelings and thoughts. That's all the nefesh. We even experience, you know, moral dilemmas and conscience. That's all the ruach. The neshama, we're not very in touch with our neshamas today. We throw the word around all the time. We throw the word neshama, my neshama, my neshama. We're not really very much in touch with our neshamas. We don't really, but the neshama is where prophecy happens. It's a completely separate part of the human being. The Chaim Volozhiner says an incredible, just a little piece of imagery. He says that the body is the shoe of the neshama. What?
That reminds me of that ritual. What is it? The shoe.
Halitza?
Yeah.
Says, the body is the shoe of the neshama. We typically think that like our bodies are ourselves, and like inside of us somewhere is this small little spiritual thing called a neshama, right? Like the pintaligid, I don't know, like this little small little, you know, spiritual thing inside of us called a neshama, right? That's how we kind of visualize it. We got this wrong. The body is the shoe of the neshama. The neshama is way bigger than the body. The neshama is our actual existence, which we're very much not in touch with in this physical world that we live in. And we have at the very bottom of the neshama, there's this shoe that covers the very bottom of it. And our existence today is completely wrapped up in that shoe. And our consciousness is very much about that shoe. And we're very much not conscious of our neshama at all. We're really not. Again, I'm saying this to give us a little bit of an understanding of what nevuah really is, what prophecy really is. You know, it's such a shame that you know, we have these imageries from who knows where of like this booming voice from the sky, and that's how God communicates with people. It's such a horrible it's such a horrible analogy, and it diminishes everything that there is about prophecy, about God, about communicating with people. Like, it's not like that at all, right? And if we have this understanding, first of all, we'd be a lot less susceptible to false prophets. I mean, false prophets, I mean, if prophecy is God, you know, a booming voice comes from the sky, it's okay. I don't know. Maybe there was a booming voice that came to this guy. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know who God decides to talk to. Like, if you realize that prophecy doesn't talk to, it has to talk to a neshama. Like, and it's a different, it's the code. It's a whole different communication. It's not human wisdom. It uses a different faculty of the human being that we're not even in touch with. You know, it'll give us a glimpse of what it is. So again, I'm just gonna, based on what we just said, I'm gonna read the Rambam one more time how he defines that, and then we'll stop and have any questions anybody has. So we must realize there exist human beings who have such lofty qualities and achieve such great perfection that their souls, the neshama, become prepared to receive pure spiritual wisdom. And they receive this pure spiritual wisdom, which is not anything that our minds can grasp, our minds which exist in the nefesh. Their human intellect can then become bound up with the creative mind, meaning their brains, their nefesh and their ruach, can then become bound up with the creative mind, the seichel apol that gets into their neshama. And then they can do something about it, receive an inspired emanation, etc. That's prophecy. People who achieve this are prophets. And you just achieve it. You achieve prophecy. You don't get prophecy. You know, prophecy is not something that you get one day.
You have to make yourself ready for it.
Well, that's what he means. If you achieve that level of awareness of your neshama, right, then God can communicate to you through your neshama. Right.
It's like changing the receiver.
It requires a completely different receiver. Prophecy requires a different receiver than anything else. Yes. Okay. And then he says, this is the concept of prophecy. A full explanation would require a lengthy discussion. We do not intend to recite proof text of every principle or explain how prophecy is attained. In passing, however, I will remind you that many verses in the Torah testify to the prophecy of many different prophets. So,
The question I have is, I understand the analogy about the receiver and what you said, but I thought no one alive today, and no one has been alive for a few centuries at least, a long time, has ever been a prophet.
If someone's at my door, give me one second, I'll be back on to that question.
Okay.
Okay, I'm back. You're right. There hasn't been prophecy for a long time. Prophecy ended with the death of Ezra and Malachi, which is right around the Hanukkah story, which is actually something I wanted to get into today. We didn't get into it yet. Why prophecy ended, how prophecy ended, what do we do in a post-prophecy world? How are we supposed to know things? And that's it's actually a true point. There is no prophecy today. There's nobody today who is a prophet. We still have the Torah, and we have wise people, and we listen to them. But everything we understand about Hashem right now is all using our minds, our intellects, but we're actually not in touch with Hashem on that level. Therefore, we don't have a prophecy. It's critical that there was prophecy at some point in the world, but we don't have it today. And we'll talk about why it went away and when exactly next week. But that's the short answer to that.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. Okay, I can answer any questions now. We're officially done for today. But if anybody has any questions, I'll answer them.
I have one.
Sure.
Do you think that God speaks to us through our neshama? That's the way in which we get sort of direction from God?
I mean, we have our neshama, we have a certain sensitivity within us that when we have a conscience that innately knows right from wrong. We definitely can be in touch with that. I wouldn't call that prophecy. That's not prophecy. That's not a communication from God. That's just we were created with faculties to understand certain things that are right or wrong, et cetera. But I wouldn't say that's a communication. We're built with faculties to have a sensitivity towards these things. And the more spiritual a person gets, the more innately sensitive they'll be to spirituality, the reality of spirituality in the world. But that I wouldn't call that a communication.
Do you think that that's a part of the way in which God helps us make better choices? God gives us free will to do what we want, but if you make better choices by having better values or whatever, there's always been something innate that comes from inside that drives that.
Yeah, that's the Yetzer Tov. That's the Yetzer Tov. That's our good inclination inside of us. Some call it the conscience, some call it a Yetzer Tov. We do have a moral compass inside of us, which we can absolutely crush and ignore, or we can learn to listen to. That's not the same thing as God talking to us. People may use the terms, you know, God's talking to me. That's, you know, I'm in touch with my innate moral compass that God gave me, and I can see that this is kind of what he wants, this is what he doesn't want. That's still something fundamentally different than actual prophecy. So yes, we definitely do have the ability today to have a sense of what God wants innately. We have that ability. And that's, you know, the Yetzer Tov inside of us. That's what I would call it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Perfect. Okay. Yes. Anybody else?
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you. Good night. Happy
Hanukkah. Thank you.
Good night.
Thank you.
Happy Hanukkah, Rabbi.
You as well.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.